Hello there. Welcome to Cool Climate Living. I'm Susan Lacey. You know, our fascination with our own history is shown in many ways. Oral history groups are cropping up all the time. Collectors of historical artefacts fill their homes and garages with them. And museums can be found in all Australian cities and many of the towns throughout the Central West. And museums have changed a lot over the recent decades. Today, we'll hear from the Orange Museum, the Age of Fishes Museum in Canoundra, and the Oberon Museum. Let's hear what their collections are about and how they're all striving to make their museums even more engaging and relevant. We're now going to hear from Sally McLennan. Sally is the Public Engagement and Education Officer at the Orange Museum, and Sally is very new in her role. Sally, thank you so much for joining me today. Now, I realise that because you've not been there for a super long period of time, I'm not expecting you to give me a long history of the Orange Museum, but it is fairly new, isn't it?
Yeah, I believe it opened in 2017, but after, I think, you know, two decades of the community advocating for an institution like that to be built in Orange.
And the museum is sort of part of the art gallery and library complex, isn't it?
Yeah, we call it the cultural precinct around Orange City Council. So the library and the art gallery are just next door, and we share a building with the Orange Visitors Information Centre as well. Lots happening.
Now, I figure there must have been a lot of changes occurring in the way that museums are run these days. Can you shed any light on that for us?
Sure. Well, it's from my perspective, but I think there's been a lot of changes in the last few decades, and some of them are that people are really looking for interactive experiences within museums, not looking so much to just observe objects in cases, but having hands-on experiences where they can kind of engage with objects and stories through an interactive process, and, you know, one that might appeal to multiple generations at the same time. That's one of the main ones that I've noticed in my experience.
You know, I went to the Orange Museum a few weeks ago, and you had an exhibition of people working in Orange way back in the early 1900s.
Yeah, so that's our new exhibition. It's called All in a Day's Work, and it features 78 photographs from the Central Western Daily Negative collection, which are photographs that were taken for the local paper, the Central Western Daily. And the photographs that we've used date between 1955 and 1974. And you're right, they all centre around that theme of the working lives of people in the Orange District in that period. It's a pretty impressive exhibition because it's curated from more than 1.25 million negatives that are in the Central Western Daily Negative Collection. So the Orange and District Historical Society are the custodians of that collection now. The Central Western Daily gifted that collection to the Historical Society, and they've spent most of the last 10 years going through that whole collection, cataloguing, rehousing, and digitising those images.
So, my gosh, what an effort.
Yes, I know, it's pretty monumental.
Well, I enjoyed a number of things about that exhibition, but one in particular I think probably reflects some of the changes that you've just spoken about, because, for instance, it's not just a whole series of photos in glass-covered display cabinets, but you've got huge photos all around the walls, and they're very commanding, and it makes it a lot easier to engage with when you've got such a vibrant and noticeable display, not sort of trying to squint at little photos.
Yeah, we've got some banners that run along the wall that show some of these photographs. So they measure 2 metres by 2.5 metres. And then we have some really, really huge multimedia screens that show digital projections of the photographs, and they're, you know, floor to ceiling height nearly, and our ceiling's really high. So it's really a testament to the quality of the negatives that, you know, we're able to show them at such scale, because it really shows the resolution of those images. You can see stitches on people's jumpers, you can see, you know, wrinkles in the corners of people's eyes, you can really see those, you know, minute details that are kind of lost in iPhone photography now to an extent.
Mm, absolutely.
Yeah, so and I guess being able to view them in multiple ways is really valuable as well. It kind of, when they're at a different scale, you notice different things about each of the images.
Well, you've used technology really well in that particular exhibition. I figured that this is a hallmark of ongoing exhibitions as well, because one of the things that I noticed was that the image focuses in on a particular object and then moves back out again.
Yes.
So the whole image is animated.
Yes, it's a good old Ken Burns effect. I don't know if you're familiar with Ken Burns' historical documentary work, but he uses this zooming in and out to focus the viewer's eye on particular aspects of an image, and it's a really powerful way of highlighting something that might go unnoticed normally, or drawing your attention to what I suppose the exhibition curator wants you to focus on initially.
Yeah, so technology's changed a lot of things about the way that we see images. I mean, you're talking about the film negatives. So one of the benefits of that old device called film is that it was capable of extreme resolution that digital technology is trying to match, but I don't believe it's really still there. So you're relying on old technology for the source of your images, and you're using new technology to make them much more interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
Let me just come back to a comment that you made a little while ago about the differences in museums now compared to the way that they were decades ago. And part of this is reflected, I think, in your title. So you're the Public Engagement and Education Officer. I doubt very much that decades ago such a position even existed.
I don't think so. I'm not sure. It's a bit of a mouthful anyway, but I guess it's a reflection, yes, of the different ways that people want to engage with spaces such as museums and galleries, but also reflects the shift in how institutions like museums want to bring people in, I suppose. Recognition that they're more of a democratic space, so it's not just for a select few who might be interested in a particular type of history or art or education, but a reflection that it should be a space that everyone can use. So we're really conscious of designing public programs that accompany our exhibitions that serve as many people as possible.
So do you have talks and presentations in association with each of your exhibitions, or how are you actually doing that in detail?
Yeah, sure. We sure do have a series of events that run alongside our exhibition program. So we run floor talks, we run family-friendly after-hours events where we'll put on talks that are aimed at maybe the parents and adults, but also catering to children as well. So we're keeping the children occupied and engaged in those stories that we're telling in the museum at the same time. Friday evening, the 26th of July, we have a floor talk being given by Liz Edwards, one of the curators of All in a Day's work, talking about the role of the Historical Society in curating that exhibition and looking after that Central Western Daily Negative collection, and sharing some of her insights into the images from her perspective as a historian and as a former journalist who worked with the Central Western Daily. So that's a pretty special program.
Sally, when does this exhibition close?
The 13th of October.
Oh, good. Okay.
So I have other programs that I can talk about that aren't next week. We're also, I guess, trying to not just talk about the past, but talk about how some of these themes are present in contemporary life. So on the 23rd of August, we're hosting a couple of award-winning photojournalists from Sydney to come up and speak about their contemporary practice in that photojournalism and narrative storytelling through photography, and talking about how they capture the beauty in everyday life, but also the challenge. And I think that's really reflected in this exhibition of historic photos as well. So it'll be a nice counterpoint from the, you know, historical to the contemporary.
Okay, so the picture that's emerging for me is that you've got a particular exhibition, but you've got a cluster of activities that are all sort of in line with the main theme of your exhibition. Is that a fair enough?
Yeah, we try and link the programs that the public programs that we're running to some of the themes in our exhibition, but we also run other events and activities that might not be connected to a specific exhibition. So we have some events happening for Science Week. We're holding a screening of the Cinema International Science Film Festival at the museum. So I guess that's appealing to a slightly different audience, perhaps, but still filling that historical and scientific space that museums often play in. So we, you know, come up with a suite of programs that tie quite closely to a particular exhibition, but also might hold other activities that address a different need.
No, I think that sounds terrific. What about school children? Have you got particular sessions for the school kids?
Yeah, so, well, it's school holidays right now as I'm talking to you, so I've just been running a series of school holiday programs over the last couple of weeks, including some computer coding workshops where we use the historic photos from the exhibition and then we're coding a time travel adventure, flipping between different time periods, which the kids have really been enjoying.
And is, I bet.
And it's something that the kids now have to do in school as part of the school curriculum to learn those kinds of skills, so it ties in with those things as well. So we usually run a school holiday program with some crafty activities as well. But also we're open for schools to come and visit us. So we don't charge for schools to come and visit, and I usually take the students around the museum and we do workshops or worksheets or just talk about some of the objects and images in the museum that relate specifically back to what they might be learning in their curriculum in the classroom.
Oh, that makes sense. All right, so the museum is still very young. You've got a lot of terrific, vibrant programs working at the moment. What about the future?
I suppose, you know, we want to continue being a centre for people to learn about the history of the region, but perhaps not just the history of the region, and bringing other exhibitions to Orange that people might not be able to get to Sydney or Canberra to see. So kind of being a cultural hub that provides access for people in the Central West to some of those higher profile exhibitions about history and technology and science, storytelling really. So I guess being that hub.
Well, there are a lot of synergies there because you are co-located with the library and with the art gallery.
For sure, yeah. Yep.
So for the rest of the year and ongoing, how do people get to know what is coming up?
We have some exciting exhibitions coming up after All in a Day's Work closes in October. In November, we're opening a travelling exhibition from Sydney Living Museums called Underworld, and it shows some really interesting mugshots of, I guess, criminals and gangsters from the 1920s that were referred to at the time as the specials. So it's a really beautiful photographic exhibition as well. We put all of our information, our what's on and upcoming exhibitions on our website. So if you Google Orange Regional Museum, it should come up. But we also have a Facebook and Instagram account if there are any social media followers out there.
More and more every day, I think.
Yes, so that's probably the best way to keep in touch and find out about upcoming exhibitions and also some of those programs and events that I mentioned as well.
That's marvellous. Sally, thank you very much for joining me today. Did I mention to you that I usually play a piece of music at the end of each interview?
Oh, look, I'm just thinking I've called one of our events that's coming up in September, the Family Friendly Up Late. I'm calling it A Hard Day's Night, so maybe that's a good one from the Beatles.
Thanks very much, Sally. We've been listening to Sally McLennan. Sally is the Public Engagement and Education Officer with the Orange Museum. Sally, thank you very much for talking to us today, and we're going to go to A Hard Day's Night by the Beatles. Thanks, Sally.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night, I should be sleeping like a log. But when I get home to you, I find the things that you do will make me feel alright. You know I work all day to get your money to buy a thing. everything. So why on earth should I moan? Cause when I get you alone, you know I feel okay. When I'm home, everything seems to be right. When I'm home, feeling you holding me tight, tight, yeah. It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard
guest is Anne Clark. Anne is the manager of the Age of Fishes Museum in Canoundra. Anne, thanks very much for joining our program today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Anne, the Age of Fishes Museum in Canoundra, how long has it been going?
It's an amazing place. It's been here for about 20 years, and it's an association that runs it of about 124 members. So it's a local community facility, actually. Cabong Council owns the building, but a local association actually runs it and keeps the museum going.
And why was it decided that you needed this particular type of museum in the first place?
Well, there's only two fossil museums in the world, and we're one of them. But 11 caves from here on the Goolagong Road, they had a fantastic find. In the 1950s, road grader operator accidentally hit a slab, and on it was 360 million-year-old fossils of ancient fish that were in this area. And Dr. Ritchie went back 25 years later and opened up the site and removed 80 tons of a whole community of fish fossils from that era. Why these fish were so important is one of them helped prove the continents was once joined together, because it's been found in Greenland, Canoundra and Antarctica. But also our fish had armor plating, lungs and gills, and the pentadactyl or five fingers in their fins. So they were showing the progression from the water to the land and the first animals on Earth. David Attenborough came here in 2013 and described them as world-class. That whole community was perfectly preserved from a freshwater billabong.
Isn't that just extraordinary?
Amazing, actually, and so perfectly preserved. You can see their spinal cords, their fins, their scales. One of our fish, actually, I call him Mr. Fairfaxi, is the New South Wales State Fossil Emblem as well.
Oh, good heavens. Oh, I guess you must get a lot of interest from people who are fascinated by fossils. Do they have a particular name?
Paleontologists study remains from the past, yes, living things from the past. We've actually got three paleontologists from the Australian Museum coming from the 29th of July to the 4th of August to set up our 80 tonnes of fossils in our storage facility, and they'll be having a free fossil roadshow that night for the community to visit too.
So who comes to the museum besides these paleontologists?
Well, we have more than 10,000 visitors a year, both internationally and nationally. We would have more than 37 schools visit each year and coaches. So it's a science hub. It's also a research hub. And it's a museum, but it's also a visitor information centre. So we have a lot of grey nomads come through Canoundra and drop in as well. So it's very multi-purpose, this facility.
It must be a real draw card for Canoundra.
Most definitely. We won gold at the Regional Tourism Awards last year, and we were a finalist in the New South Wales Tourism Awards, and we're also a finalist this year for the Regional Tourism Awards. So we'll see what happens next week.
Oh, yeah. Gosh, that'd be exciting.
It is. We're up against some pretty big guns from out west, but you've got to be in it to win it, so we'll try.
Yeah, absolutely.
The amazing thing is we only run on 12 volunteers, so there's not many museums that could run just on 12 volunteers.
And how is the museum subsidised?
As I said, Cabon Council owns the buildings, and they pay for my wage, but the rest is just volunteers, so it's pretty impressive. The association pays for a part-time assistant manager and a cleaner, so they do pretty well, I think, and otherwise it's just volunteers.
So what are some of your favourite pieces in the museum?
Definitely Mr. Fairfaxi, which is the New South Wales State Fossil Emblem. But it's also some of the fossils that these fish have lungs and gills in the one body, an arm of plating, I just find beyond belief. And you can actually see that pentadactyle, or those five fingers, in their fins.
Is that the one that most people come to the museum to see? Are there other public favourites?
No, I think they're probably the big ones, but we have 80 tonnes, so we have a lot of specimens that people can look at.
When you say 80 tonnes,
yes.
These are great big blocks of stone, right?
Yes, they're sandstone, and the fish were perfectly preserved in these. What they think happened was that there was either volcanic activity or there was a drought, but what happened was the billabong was rapidly covered with sediment, and so that's how the whole community was perfectly preserved, either from the volcanic ash or from the drought event and the silt covering them.
And can you describe the region around Canoundra where they've actually come from? Was it just one spot, or is it more generally distributed?
Well, this area is quite fascinating because if you go to Molong, you can actually see seashells in the rocks. Mm. But this, where we are, this was a local freshwater billabong 360 million years ago. The coast of New South Wales has changed significantly. Originally, the coast of New South Wales was near Uluru, and it's only with volcanic activity and time that it's extended outwards to where it is now. So this whole region has been affected by many different events, including volcanoes and seawater infiltration.
Are there many other sort of fossil sites around New South Wales?
There is indeed. And in fact, there's fossil trails. So, for example, if you go to Wellington Caves, you can see the big megafauna, or the giant wombats, which were as big as me. And again, as you go down the coast and Wee Jasper, there's other fossil remains. So, yes, New South Wales has got huge, huge deposits of fossil remains, and I'm sure our paleontologists could give even more information on it when they come up from the 29th of July to the 4th of August. In the 1st of August, so that's the Fossil Roadshow from 4 to 7pm. We also have, during the year, from the Maritime Museum, temporary exhibitions. So the Maritime Museum in Sydney has already given us the Shackleton and a shipwreck exhibition, but they're also going to be giving us in August and October and November some exhibitions that they have on war and peace and the Battle of the Coral Sea and the Operation Jaywick. So we work in association with the Australian Museum and the Maritime Museum.
Oh, look, I think those sorts of partnerships are really necessary, aren't they? Because they not only to give you the chance to share resources, but you can learn a lot from each other.
Most definitely. I think there's to have the availability of paleontologists here is fantastic.
Now, Anne, tell me, how did you get interested in paleontology?
Well, I have a science degree, and I taught science for more than 30 years, and I retired and then didn't know what to do with myself, and
yeah, common
became
problem.
A manager of a museum, as you do.
Yeah. Yes, your enthusiasm is in your voice, I can hear it.
Oh, I love the place. I think it's great because it's also an open classroom for Canoundra Public, so that we invite all schools in the area to use the museum as an open classroom, and we'll cater for their... Canoundra Public has written a whole heap of programs and units of work for primary school, and we're happy that any school comes in here and uses those programs and units of works. And we invite all the community. We often have conferences here free for local communities, events. We love people to use this museum. It's a science hub, it's a research facility, it's a visitor information centre, it's everything.
Now, tell me, what does it look like as you walk in the front door? Because I'm intrigued by all these great big rocks.
Oh, okay. So we have the entrance. We have four billabongs, and we have David Attenborough at the front. His video of his visit here, and he's going through looking at the fossil stands and all the fossil displays that we had here.
Well, I think that the kids in Canoundra are very privileged to be able to have this type of resource so close to them. They must all be experts in fossils.
Well, actually, a lot of people don't even know this museum exists, to be quite honest. The amount of people that don't know about it is phenomenal, and yet it's so important to the history of the world. So it was from a National Heritage site that the fossils were obtained, and, you know, they are world-class. David Attenborough described them as world-class, so the more people that know about it, the better.
Well, I hope so. You know what, I have never been to Canoundra, and it's always been in my mind that I should go there. And now I know a destination.
Well, we get a lot of people from Sydney that pull up here and say, wow, I could buy a house here and own it. It's flat. I can walk the streets. People say hello to me. And if I'm ill, I can go to Cowra or I can go to a regional hospital in Orange. So we've actually had a lot of people lately walk up and down the street and say, wow, you know, this has got a lot going for it. It's a very fertile area agriculturally, even though we're in a drought, but it's very fertile. It's had lucerne production and cropping and livestock. So I think a lot of people don't quite appreciate how much Canoundra has to offer everybody.
I think probably that could be said about many of the country towns in the central west.
Most definitely. And we are central to the central west here, because we're so close to Forbes and Parkes and Cowra. So, yes, I would agree that there's a lot of hidden gems in this region that most people don't even know exist.
Here I am thinking that your museum covers a long distant past, and Parkes is covering our future and amazing technology.
Yes. Yes, there's a lot of opportunities in this area.
Right. I think that having a science trail around the area. I guess you've all probably thought about these sorts of things already.
Well, I noticed Dubbo is now combining their tourist attractions with the zoo and the jail. So, yes, we work hand in hand with Bathurst. They have the most amazing gem and mineral display. So, yes, we do work in association and with the local museum. So we actually open the historical museum in Canoundra Monday, Wednesday and Friday, because it's got such amazing displays. For example, they've got one of the first utes ever built.
One of the first utes.
Yes. They've got one of the first Caterpillar tractors, and there's only two in Australia. First digital clock, first tape recorder, and it's all hidden treasures in the historical museum at Canoundra too. But we open that Monday, Wednesday and Friday as well with our visitors.
And the Age of Fishes Museum, is that open every day?
Yes, open 7 days a week, 10 till 4 each day.
And if we think about the people who are coming in to visit, what kinds of questions do they ask generally?
Well, we offer them a tour or an audio guide, but a lot of people are just impressed by our facilities, because we have free picnic tables and free barbecue. We have facilities for all hearing loops for those that cannot hear. So we have a lot of facilities here for everybody. But most people that come in ask for directions, and they love our free maps.
Oh, yes.
So, yes, and what's available in this region. So we give them actually a summary of the top 50 things to do in this area.
Do you have a website?
Yes, 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 we do.
How can people find out more about the museum?
If you just put in Age of Fishes Museum on Google, you can get our site, or alternatively it's www.ageoffishes.org.au, and or give us a ring on 0263441008, and we'd love to see you here.
Can you say that phone number again?
0263441008.
Okay, that's fantastic. And thank you very much for joining us today. And sounds as if the museum is truly fascinating and obviously a very special museum. It's amazing that in Australia we have such an extraordinary resource. Thanks very much for joining me today.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate it. And I appreciate you letting us tell the world about our fantastic museum.
Right, that's great. Thanks, Anne. We've been listening to Anne Clark, the very enthusiastic manager of the Age of Fishes Museum, and obviously really well worth getting to have a look at. And I will close our interview with a piece of music. And I know that you're keen on John Denver. What piece of music would you like me to play?
Yes, Country Road, Take Me Home.
Well, that sounds just about right.
Because the word Canoundra actually means home.
Is that right?
Yeah, so there you go. How appropriate.
It certainly is. That's amazing. Thank you very much, Anne.
Good on you. Thanks for your time.
Almost heaven, West Virginia, Blue Ridge Mountains, Shenandoah River. Life is old there, older than the trees, younger than the mountains, growing like a breeze. Country roads, take me home to the place. Moonshine, teardrop in my eye, country roads, take me home to the place.
Person to join the program is Cole Roberts. Cole is the president of the Oberon Museum, but he's also had a long period of interest in local history projects. He's written a book about the development of forestry in Oberon, going back quite some decades, and many other local history projects. Cole, thanks very much for joining me today.
Very good.
Why did you take on the role of president?
Well, the museum, about 6 months ago, was in a period of recess because the committee had sort of run out of steam and it needed someone to come in and reinvigorate the museum. So I offered to put together a committee that was interested in giving it a bit of new life. And I found some people who were accepted into the membership, and we established a new committee for the museum in January this year. And I guess because I was the instigator, they put me in as president.
Oh, I can see that coming, yes. Oh, you're interested in local history, are you? Oh, okay, yeah, you want to be president too, don't you? I know, that's the way it happens. Cole, tell us a little bit more about the museum itself. When was it first set up?
Yeah, actually the museum turns 30 years old this year. It was established in 1989, and in those days it was established in the buildings of the railway station, because 10 years prior to that the train had stopped running and the station buildings were open to the public and were being vandalised. And they were being vandalised to the extent that the council was thinking of pushing them down. Mm-hmm. But prior to doing that, they offered it to Ray and Laurie McMahon as a place possibly for them to establish a museum collection.
Now, they're both intensely interested in local history, aren't they? They've been collectors in Oberon for a very long time.
They have, and they were looking for somewhere to put their collection of material. So that's the reason that they took on the offer of the station buildings. And within 2 years of that, they'd formed a museum society and incorporated them. So community members joined the museum, and they started raising money to restore these railway buildings, to restore the platform, and to buy some carriages which they could display their collections in. Mm-hmm. And that period of intense activity was during the early 90s, and the museum was quite active in those days, and a lot of the donations that came in from the community came in during that period when there was a lot of community consciousness about the museum and a real enthusiasm for this concept of a museum.
Well, the Oberon Museum, the museum component of it, is really part of quite an extensive heritage precinct, isn't it? So the railway is still there, and there's a group that's responsible for that?
Yes, these days the museum has moved into buildings behind the railway station, so it's still in the station precinct, but the actual station itself is occupied by the Oberon to Taranau Rail Heritage Group, who have an interest in keeping the line and even opening it for tourism purposes. So the museum's just moved into behind the station buildings, and we have a building there and an area that is used to store all our implements and some sheds. We have a blacksmith shop, we have a cottage, and we have a pavilion there.
Okay. Now, let's talk about the types of exhibits that you've got within all of these buildings. Where did most of the exhibits come from, Cole?
Okay, we have two sources. Firstly, there's a very large amount of the exhibits are the collections of Ray and Laurie McMahon. They've been passionate collectors for years and have put together an amazing collection of all sorts of different things. Very eclectic collections. Strange things that probably other people wouldn't think of collecting, they've managed to make a collection out of. And it's very interesting. It's the surprises you when you go into the museum, all the sorts of different things that you can collect. But added to that has been community donations, donations from local families who have put in something that they thought would be of interest in a museum. And it's amazing the amount of material that has been donated locally. So between the collections of Ray and Laurie McMahon and donations from the community, we have a really interesting cross-section of Oberon history. Starting, of course, right down the back corner, we have an 1887 timber cottage, which was just on the outskirts of town and was transported into the Oberon Museum in 1993 on the back of a truck and set up in the museum grounds. And this cottage is in its original condition, and it has got period furniture in it from the early 1800s, and it's an amazing display of how people lived over 100 years ago. It's a real treasure that we've got to look after. It's got a lot of embroidery in it, a lot of clothes in it, a lot of furniture which is pre-electricity days, and all sorts of stuff which people find fascinating just to think that people lived in this manner.
Is it a slab construction?
No, it's what do they call it, a kit home constructed by Hudson people from America. They used to import Baltic pine into Sydney, and Hudson's were a big timber country, and they put together these kit cottages, which one of them was bought out to Oberon by Sid Badcock, actually, to build a home for his mother, who was an asthmatic and needed to have clear country air to improve her health. And that was in 1887, yeah.
Now, I understand there's also a lot of very big machinery there. What kind of machinery have you got? Why is it important in terms of Oberon's history?
Yeah, well, Oberon has a very strong rural background, of course. We have been a rural community for over 100 years, and of course the early settlers all had to be fairly self-sufficient. So they had horses for their tractors, if you like, in those days, so they needed to grow grain for their horses and chaff, and they needed to grow food for themselves. So there was a lot of fruit trees, there was a lot of potato growing and pea growing. And as the town grew, there were areas of agriculture which obviously suited Oberon quite significantly. And one of those was the pea-growing era. Mm. Just after the Second World War, we were very big at growing peas. And we have lots of pea-growing equipment there. And initially, the peas were grown and lifted with a vine lifter, and processed in Oberon in an Edgewells processing plant, and then taken down to Bathurst for processing into canned peas. But because Oberon's quite close to the Sydney markets, they very soon found that fresh peas could get a premium price, and so fresh pea growing, where the pods are actually picked off the vines by pea pickers, became a major industry in Oberon, and we would have hundreds of tonnes being sent down to the Sydney markets each week, some on the trains, some on trucks. And pea growing was very big for about a decade after the Second World War.
And what kind of equipment have you got in the museum that reflects that particular era?
Well, there, of course, are scarifiers and early tractors, because in the period just after the war, there wasn't a lot of machinery available. So we've got very early horse-drawn equipment and early tractors and early rural equipment, some of it which is modified from the horse-drawn era, for cultivating, for lifting the pea vines, and for processing the pea vines. But also in the potato era, because the potatoes were quite big in the area, because they were readily saleable to the Sydney markets as well, but also, you know, it was a big local market for potatoes before the supermarket era.
Yeah.
So potatoes were big, so there were potato lifters, and these sorts of things were very common part of rural life in those early days. Haymaking equipment too.
Oh, there's haymaking equipment.
We have numerous chaff cutters, but we also have a very interesting setup called a hay steamer, where a lot of the stalks that were made into chaff were softened by a steaming process. So they would be run up a steamer before they entered the chaff cutter. And we have also the horse works, which has been restored to drive the chaff cutter that would make the chaff. So you've got the horse going around and around the horse works, driving the chaff cutter, and the stalks of the crop being fed into the steamer to soften it before it goes into the chaff cutter. Chaff was a very important part of the agriculture in the days when horses were your chief source of power. So everyone had haystacks, everyone had chaff cutters, and everyone had horses as their main means of powering their agriculture.
Now, all of this equipment, I imagine, has been out in the open for some time. With the plans that you have for the museum, how are you going to go about restoring some of this equipment?
Well, we're going to tackle it at two levels. Firstly, as a museum, we have an obligation to preserve, display and interpret the items that we've got in the museum. And we've placed a very high priority on the preservation action because, as you say, a lot of them have been outside in the open for a while. So we put a high priority on trying to get some funding to get some sheds to put these machines in so that they're out of the Oberon weather. And a lot of them, you know, are starting to rust and to deteriorate. So it's really important as a museum curator, I guess, is to get those things, to stop them from deteriorating anymore. So firstly, we want to get sheds to put them in, and that's a process which is underway. But we've also got together a group of people under the U3A movement, the University of the Third Age, have put together a heritage machinery restoration group. This group is an interesting group of men who have come together because of their interest in machines, and we've fed them with items out of the museum to restore. And they're having a wonderful time at the moment, not only having a sharing a joke and conversations, but in putting their minds to some of the problems that these old bits of machinery present, giving them a new lease of life by getting rid of some rust and putting them back into working order without necessarily making them look sparkling new, but just putting them back into working order so that they won't deteriorate anymore and they will be presentable and displayable and we can tell their story then.
And I bet they're having a great time. Are many of them farmers, local farmers?
Some of them are farmers. Most of them are retired.
Yeah.
But they're missing the things that farmers do, which is mucking around with bits of machinery when they need to and innovating, making things that out of what's available. But we also have retired tradespeople, many of them with skills. And to see these people working together, they're bouncing ideas off each other and they're talking, sharing a joke and learning from each other. So, of course,
it's good for them as well.
It's good for them. Mm. And also they have amongst themselves a network of people that they know that might be able to help out if we need a spare part or if we need this or if we need that. Oh, I know a fella who's got one of those. I'll go and see him. And before we know it, we've got tentacles going out in all sorts of places with people who have similar interests and who might be able to help us out with a particular item for the museum. It might be a spare part or it might be a missing part. So I'm just encouraging this little group to work with the museum because I think it has enormous potential to get our rural equipment in top condition.
Now, the community has been involved in another type of exhibit too, and that's the streetscape. Tell me about that, Cole.
Yeah, well, just prior to the bicentennial, so we're talking 1987, the daycare residents at the hospital, and these are the senior citizens who come in for activities during the day, were encouraged to take on a project as a bicentennial project, and what they chose was to do a streetscape of Oberon's main street as they remembered it in the 30s. Now, these were people who were senior citizens in 1987, and most of them could remember what the main street looked like back in their younger days. And we had some photos that they used to help them jog their memories. And they started, with the aid of a professional potter, to build accurate representations of all the buildings in the main street. And it is a fascinating project. There is nearly 2,000 pottery pieces in this collection. Mm. The buildings are clearly identifiable today, the ones that are still there. And of course, you've got the Malachine, you've got the bank, you've got Ramsgate, you've got the two hotels are all instantly recognisable. Some of the Imperial Arcade shops are still there. They're all recognisable because they're accurate representations of the day. But the interesting thing, of course, is that back in the 1930s there was no sewage, so there's a dunny out the back of every shop and there is animals and there's wood heaps and there's all sorts of things that aren't there these days.
Yeah.
And it's easy to see that the oldies had a sense of humour too when they were doing this, because there's snakes in dunnies and there's and there's goats standing on the top of wood heaps. And you know, it is a delightful representation of what Oberon might have looked like back in the 1930s.
You know, what's emerging for me here is that it's not just a museum where a couple of people have set something up a long time ago, but the Oberon community and the surrounding districts are intensely interested in what happens, what has happened, and they've made a big contribution to it already. And it sounds as if they're still wanting to do that.
Well, we hope so. What we find is that we have a really large photographic collection, and in the early days there were schools everywhere in the district, and some of the photographs have come from all these different schools around the district, and a lot of people come in and they say, oh, I went to this school, I wonder if there are my photos there. And they look for themselves as a kid in these school photos that we've got from all the little schools that were surrounded Oberon. And, of course, we've got a number of villages in the area. We've got Burriga and Black Springs and Edith and Hazelgrove, and they all have a history of their own, which we have been working on to adequately represent in the museum. Burraga has its own history, which is fascinating because it was a bigger town than Oberon in its day when the copper mine was going. So that, you know, we have very interesting pictures and history from the Burraga area. Black Springs was very early in our agricultural history, and there's a lot of old families down there, and their family is... histories have been collected and are represented not only by the Black Springs community themselves, but by some of our family history that we've got in the museum.
Well, it's clear that there's been a fabulous community involvement. All right, so what you've described is absolutely fascinating, Cole. And if people want to come and visit the museum, when is it open and how can they get there?
Okay. The museum is open every Sunday of the year between 10 o'clock and 4 o'clock. We also open on Saturday afternoons of the first Saturday of the month, which is when Oberon has its monthly markets. So we're open on the first Saturday of the month and every Sunday. And the museum is accessible from Scotia Avenue, which goes off North Street, but the buildings of the museum are just at the back of the railway station. So you get in via Scotia Avenue.
All right, Cole, it's been a fascinating story, and my best wishes for the ongoing development, and I hope that it continues to thrive.
Thank you very much, Susan.
Okay, we've been listening to Cole Roberts. Cole is the president of the Oberon Museum, and clearly has some great plans and some great ways of getting local community involvement in the museum itself. Thanks a lot for joining me today, Cole.
Okay.
You've been listening to Cool Climate Living. I'm Susan Lacey. Join me again next time. Bye for now.
Started out from round two, and the shims that all cut out. Queen whips and whips a rhino that we meant to push about. And we humped our blue serenely and made for Sydney town with a three-spot check between us that wanted knocking down. We camped in Lazy Harry's on the road to Gundagai, the road to Gundagai, 5 miles from Gundagai. We camped at Lazy Harry's on the road to Gundagai.
We crossed the Murrumbidgee near Old Yanko in a week. We passed around the Randra, we crossed Burnett Creek. We never stopped at Wagga Wagga in Sydney in our eye. We counted Lazy Harry's on the road to Gundagai.
We counted Lazy Harry's on the road to Gundagai, yeah. The road to Gundagai, 5 miles from Gundagai. We counted Lazy Harry's on the road to Gundagai. We threw our flaming swags off and marched into the bar. We ordered rum and raspberry and a shilling a cigar. And the girl that served the poison winked at Roger and I. And we camped at Lazy Harry's on the road to Gundagai. We camped at Lazy Harry's on the road to Gundagai. The road to Gundagai, 5 miles from Gundagai. We camped at Lazy Harry's on the road to Gundagai.
Was all knocked down. We sold our Matildas and we turned back on town. The girl served a nobbler. We sadly waved goodbye. We tramped from Lazy Harry's on the road to Gundagai.
We tramped from Lazy Harry's on the road to Gundagai. The road to Gundagai, 5 miles from Gundagai. We tramped from Lazy Harry's on the road to Gundagai. We've seen a lot of girls and we've drunk a lot of beer and met
for some of us, me lads, that's left us feeling queer. Up the beer to knock you sideways. Girls to make you cry, you should camp at Lazy Harry's on the road, the under guy. You should camp at Lazy Harry's on the road, the under guy. The road, the under guy. 5 miles of Gundagai. You should camp at Lazy Harry's on the road, the under guy.
Very much, thank you.